What I thought I'd do this morning is just sort of briefly tell the story of my guys using some pictures that were taken overseas to sort of bring that story to life, to lay the foundation for a few of the things that I took out of there. I actually have another book coming out from Random House on the military concept of servant leadership and the sort of military concept of the formation of character, which is, of course, informed by Scripture and by the Christian concept of the formation of character. So I thought I would take some of those learnings and try and unpack them a little bit this morning as we delve into the exploration of ethics and doing the right thing and work. So, and I'm an accidental author. I didn't mean to write a book. I did not mean to. Certainly didn't ever think it would get published. And the reason that I wrote was because I felt that I had really let my men down when I was leading them overseas. And by that I mean I did not write them up for enough awards. Because when someone is 19 or 20, and they run into an enemy machine gun position, they run into heavy fire, and they rescue one of their wounded comrades and maybe get wounded themselves, and you're their leader, there's not a lot that you can do for that 19-year-old to tell them thank you. You can't give them a promotion. You cannot give them a bonus. You can't give them a day off. You can't give them a vacation. The only thing that you can really do as their leader is take a little bit of ribbon and wrap it around some metal, and you pin it on their chest, and then you say, hey, well done, Marine. I'm proud of you. Thank you for your bravery. And I didn't do enough of that. And so when I got finished with that tour, went back to school and looked around at the peers of my men, looked around at my peers and thought, my goodness, the lives that these 18 and 19-year-olds have been living overseas are very different than the lives that my Marine, or very different than the lives that most folks have been living back here. And over and above that, what my guys did overseas was remarkable. They fought long, they fought hard, they endured a lot. And I didn't reward them appropriately. And they were all telling me kind of the same thing. And that was this: hey, sir, we don't really tell our parents about what we did. We don't tell our loved ones about what we did overseas because they just don't get it. There's nothing here in America that's at all like what we did overseas. And so you try to find these analogies and you try to point to them, and you can't. It's like trying to explain red to someone who's colorblind. It just doesn't work. So because it's so hard, we just eventually stopped trying. And I thought, that's really a shame, because what you guys did was amazing and your loved ones should know about it. So I thought, I didn't write you up for enough awards, and that's my fault. But here's what I'll try and do. I'm just going to write down your story for you, and I'll just email it to my squad leaders, and they can give it to their guys, and that way, my 19-year-old can go up to his mom or his wife or his fiance or his sister or his brother, and he can give them the book, and he can say, hey, guess what? I haven't talked about what I did overseas, but it is pretty remarkable, and my lieutenant wrote it down for me. So here you go. Now you can know what it is that I did. So one thing led to another. That collection of sort of writings became a book. The next thing I knew, I was a published author. I actually finished the book while in Kabul, Afghanistan. I got involuntarily recalled, and my editor said it was the first time he'd ever worked with someone in Afghanistan. So, well, it's the first for everything. So what's the story about? Basically, it's about my second tour leading a 40-man infantry platoon in a city called Ramadi. In 2003, I took command of the platoon. Our radio call sign was, in fact, Joker 1. We had, well, with four exceptions, every one of my men was between the ages of 18 and 21. Their backgrounds ranged the gamut. You had Joe Mahardy, who was an Irish-American kid on the dean's list at Syracuse. He dropped out to join the Marines in the wake of September 11. I had Ramsey Siebra, who is a first-generation Colombian-American who grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. He turned down multiple Division I cross-country scholarships to enlist in the wake of September 11. All of my guys were bright. They were enthusiastic. They were exactly where they wanted to be. So we trained for a little bit, for about 3 months. We didn't know what our mission was going to be, because in the end of 2003, The Marines had left Iraq entirely because they believed that there was, in fact, no fighting left to be done. By the beginning of 2004, though, it became fairly apparent that there was, in fact, still fighting left to be done, that the Marines would be going back overseas, and that Joker 1 and I would be among the first wave of Marine returnees. So we had a slow holiday schedule, and because we were staffed at about two-thirds full before we went overseas, I got my last complement of men just 2 weeks before we went overseas and deployed into Kuwait. And that was enough time for those men to do exactly one training event with us. So the question is basically, you know, what type of there you go, getting the gear for a day at the beach. It's perfect. So let me segue really quickly to Okay, so basically the question a lot of people ask is, okay, if you have these young guys and, you know, you've got 2 weeks to train and then you go overseas and you face down some of the most difficult fighting that the Corps has seen, what are they like? How do they do this? What are the Marines sort of, you know, what type of men are they? Are we going to be able to get that up and running or no? Okay. For the most part, they're very young. They're between the ages of 17 and 22. The average age of folks overseas is 20 and a half years old. They're not very big. They're small and they're wiry. In fact, they're smaller than the average American. The first time that my wife saw me with my men, or saw my men at all, was when we were sitting on a tarmac and we were waiting for the bus that would come and pick us up and take us to the plane that would take us to Iraq. And she said she nearly broke down crying when she saw me surrounded by my men, because she didn't know how I was going to live through the deployment if I was protected by such little people. most of the little people, most of them are from single parent working class families. Most of them believe that when they come back from deployment and they have their 2 weeks of liberty, their main mission in life is to take all of the freedoms that were denied them in high school and pack them into these two-week period. So, you know, they come back and they have, you know, new tattoos, they have new cars, they have, you know, the massive dog that their mom would never let them buy. And because they've been wearing uniforms, their sense of fashion, and mine is, you know, still rudimentary at best, their sense of fashion is non-existent. So they dress just like dorks. And here are those dorks. And because they're trained kind of to travel together, when you see them in their civilian clothes and you see them sort of in civilian situations, it looks like this pack of like 10 to 15 dorks just walking around. And a lot of times, people will cross to the other side of the street when they see them. But they are the most amazing and special creatures imaginable. They work 7 days a week, operating under the most demanding conditions imaginable. We're on call 24 hours a day. No one burns out. I watch them patrol for hours, literally sometimes 24 hours, in the 130-degree heat, carrying a combat load of 50 to 80 pounds, which is greater than half of their body weight. I've seen them charge machine gun positions without hesitation. I've watched them run out in the open to draw fire from a wounded comrade, literally waving their arms and screaming, "Shoot at me." I've seen them take bullets for their brothers in arms. When they are wounded, they inevitably ask the same question as soon as they can, and the question is this: "Sir, how quickly can I get back into the fight? Because I am worried that Smith or Mahardy or Camacho or Bolden, the guy to my right or to my left, won't be okay if I'm not there to take care of him. So, Doc, if you could just patch me up and send me back in the fight, I would really appreciate it." And if combat missions aren't enough, when they have some free time, we make them do continuous work improving the base, digging trenches, filling sandbags, etc. When they have spare time, they do some weird things. This is one of my guys in Iraq, because they're young and because they're Marines. And what we train these young men and we give them the power of life and death, and we ask them to use that responsibly and to make good decisions in half a second or less. And it is very easy to forget that at the end of the day, all that they are college-age kids who are placed in extraordinary situations and expected to behave extraordinarily. And in our case, that situation looked like this. We flew to Kuwait on the 19th of February. We trained for 2 weeks. And then we pushed north into Iraq in the largest rotation of men and materiel since World War II. After 3 days, we made it into Ramadi. This is what we wore the entire time there. And if you work your way from the head down, you've got a helmet, which is 4 pounds, body armor, which is 17, 6 quarts of water, which is about 10 pounds, an M16, which is 13 pounds, a pistol, which is 2.5 pounds, ammunition, et cetera, et cetera. All told, it's 50 to 80 pounds. That's what these guys are carrying, depending on the weapon system. And we wore that every time we left the base, whether we were going to be out for 30 minutes or whether we were going to be out for 3 to 4 to 5 days. Once we were there, we lived in this, which was a compound called the Combat Outpost. This is fairly typical of what the guys are living in Iraq and Afghanistan, in the remote outposts. It's in the earliest phases of rebuilding. There was no electricity. There was no running water. We were able to use a satellite cell phone once every 2 to 3 months to call home and let people know that we were okay. Eventually, we got some electricity, and eventually, we got sporadic running water, enough that we were able to take showers about once every 2 to 4 weeks. Ramadi itself was a city of 400,000 people, denser population than New York or Washington, D.C. I could walk across the city in a half an hour. We had about 160 people in my company that were responsible for this 400,000 person area. Our mission was to keep it safe and secure. So with the 160 people for 400,000, as you can imagine, it was a bit of a difficult mission. And in fact, our first casualties came when we were turning over with the unit that preceded us. We had, and you can see it here, we had a jerry-rigged Humvees where we had scavenged armor from from junkyards in Kuwait and literally tied it onto the back of the Humvees to give us some additional protection from roadside bombs. One of these was hit, and there were 4 wounded, to include one of our Marines who lost his face from the nose down. And that was the first of many casualties, and that was the first thing that let us know that this was, in fact, for real, and that we were not, in fact, on a simply a merry adventure. Initially, we walked everywhere because we did have very few Humvees. When we weren't doing these urban patrols, and this is us in a busy city center, we were doing raids, area searches, observation posts, and what you see here, was the dreaded morning route sweep. And when we did that, what we did is we put on our gear and we walked down the middle of the road that ran through Ramadi looking for bombs with our naked eye. Typically, we found them when they were between 5 and 10 feet away. So as you might imagine, it was a fairly nerve-wracking day to start your day. The country is awash in stuff like this, which is unsecured ordnance, and whenever we found it, we would confiscate it and we would destroy it. Because our city was the capital of the Anbar province, it contained all of the infrastructure necessary to govern the province. So fairly soon, we took on the responsibility of guarding the key government infrastructure 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When we had some spare time in between missions, we would do our best to perform what we called humanitarian operations to try and win some support at the grassroots level. This is one of our corpsmen having treated a sick child. About 90% of the time, our missions took place in this sort of heavily urban terrain, but occasionally we would find ourselves operating and fighting in the rural area just to the east with its lush foliage and its rolling rice paddies. There were definitely times where you could be forgiven for thinking that you were back in Vietnam. Sometimes our patrols were as short as 2 hours. Sometimes they were as long as 24. And the heat in the middle of July got up to 135 degrees. And no matter how often we got out of the base and patrolled, the stress of just constantly being surrounded by a foreign population going about its daily business was tremendous, because you never knew which of the seemingly ordinary people was going to take a shot at you, drop a grenade at your feet, or simply pull out their cell phone and detonate a hidden bomb as you walked by. Our pace was unrelenting. We were running missions 3 out of every 4 days, and the fourth day was what we called a quick reaction force day, where we sat in a room with all of our gear on, waiting to respond to anything. It wore us out. My men rarely got more than 4 hours of sleep a night. After 2 months, all of the platoon commanders, to include myself, began suffering from fairly severe insomnia, probably from the stress that comes from laying awake at night and wondering what bad decision you're going to make the next day that's either going to get your men killed or it's going to get innocent civilians killed. However, when you hear the crack of bullets that signal that someone is shooting at you and that they're close, or you hear the distant thud of a mortar tube, or you hear the double boom of an RPG fired at you, all of those vestiges of tiredness drop away. This is actually us under fire at the government center. My first firefight occurred on the 19th of March, and what happened was this. We were conducting an urban patrol. We had just crossed a major street. My last four men were crossing the street, and I heard this massive explosion. I look back, and my four men have disappeared. There's just a cloud of smoke where they used to be, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I just lost 4 Marines. Well, they came running out of the smoke. Their eyes are about as big as dinner plates. And then we started taking machine gun fire. So we turned our patrol around, started running towards the machine gun fire. I never saw the folks who were shooting at us. We come back to the base. Once the fire has ceased, we come back to the base, pull everyone in, start debriefing what has happened. And my 2 point men say, hey, sir, we actually did see the guys who were shooting us. And I said, well, you know, what were you thinking? Why did you not shoot back? We're Marines. That's our job. That's what we do. And they said, well, sir, you know, we didn't shoot back because they were firing from a group of small children. And we were worried that if we shot back, we would hit the kids. And that was a tactic that would become fairly standard throughout the remainder of our time there, and that is fairly standard for everyone overseas. We had our next massive firefight on April 6th, and that was a wake-up call for us. We fought thousands and thousands of insurgents. And in fact, it started off with one of our platoons being pinned down in 3 separate houses. Literally, the enemies had scaled the walls and were running by the houses in which they had taken refuge. They were hanging their AK-47s inside the windows and shooting. Our guys were hanging their M-16s back out and shooting back. My platoon was called to rescue them. We launched into the city. We weren't entirely sure where they were. So what we ended up doing was looking at the smoke that was rising from the city and quite literally running at the sound of the machine gun fire that we could hear until we encountered heavy resistance. Eventually, we fought our way block by block, house by house. We made it to our pinned down platoon. By the time we got there, they had no ammunition left. They had had at least 4 or 5 wounded. They had had 2 killed. Eventually, our entire 1,200-person battalion would have to deploy into the city to roll back our attackers. From that day on, we had contact with the enemy pretty much every single day. In fact, we averaged 3 enemy contacts a day, whether it was something like this, which is a roadside bomb, the mortars that were launched at us every second day. This is my platoon's compound. It was hit by a 120-millimeter mortar. Or whether that was simply direct fire, firefights with rockets and small arms. Starting in late June, continuing throughout July and August, we had to once a week deploy at least 1,000 people into the city to roll back a citywide attack. And at one point in time, one of my company's outposts, and you can see it here, it's called the Agricultural Center, was the most attacked city or the most attacked place in all of Iraq. And no matter how often we changed our tactics, we found ourselves, the enemy changed just as quickly, and we found ourselves fighting literally every single day, fiercely and often. And when you do that, no matter how good you are, prolonged and intense fighting inevitably produces casualties. In our battalion, it was one out of every three that was wounded. In my company, it was closer to one out of every two. When someone's wounded, you have about 1 hour to get them to higher echelon specialty care, which for us was Baghdad. Because our base was one of the few that was on the eastern side of the city that could land a helicopter, we facilitated a tremendous amount of these medevacs. And this is the way it would work. A wounded Marine would come in. They would be stabilized by our team of corpsmen, augmented by one doctor. We would make the decision whether to triage them to Baghdad or not. If they needed that, we would bring in a helicopter as quickly as we could. We would, or as quickly as the enemy fire permitted, we would load up the wounded and they would take them away. Most of the wounds, though, did not need higher follow-on specialty care. Most of the Marines responded the way Lance Corporal Anthony did here, which is by smoking a cigarette and saying, "Hey, Doc, when can I get back into the fight?" But when you have a lot of wounded come in at the same time, there's a grim duty that has to be performed. And this is my staff sergeant and another Marine doing that in the wake of a mass casualty evacuation. And no matter how good you are, no matter how good your doctors are, eventually, if you fight enough, you lose people. We lost 12 Marines on the 6th of April. We lost another four on the 7th through the 10th. Our sister company, Echo Company, would ultimately lose 22. They were decimated twice over. When we came back, we had lost 44 total. We were told it was the highest casualty rate that any battalion, Marine or Army, had suffered since Vietnam. Now, that has since been surpassed. And when you have casualties, we hold memorial services so that we can grieve overseas, we can honor the men as heroes. And basically, we would gather together in our hangar bay, we would honor the dead, and then we would salute the flag, and we would continue the mission. But as each day goes on and as the losses mount, you sort of carry those losses like heavy stones in your heart. And as the days go by, your heart gets heavier and heavier and heavier. So one of the things that people ask me often is, okay, if your men are 18 and 19 and 20, and this is the kind of thing they're facing, and they know that every day is going to bring a difficult fight, and they know that the odds are stacked against them in the sense that if they keep fighting, they are ultimately going to get wounded. How do they keep persevering? How do they keep going? A related question is this. In an age of kind of distrust of many of our national institutions, particularly politics and also business, why does the military have a 70% approval rating? Why is it one of the only national institutions that that America, by and large, still trusts? And I think this is one of the things that certainly underpins Colson's series is this. The military is one of the very few national institutions, and perhaps the only one, that still believes in absolutes. It still believes in right and wrong, and it's explicit about what is right and what is wrong. And what is right is not optional. You don't get to make it up. You don't get to decide for yourself. It is absolute because it is lives on the lines. And they have a leadership philosophy that is also absolute. You don't get to decide what sort of leader you're going to be. You're going to be a servant leader. And that is a simple model, but one that's very hard to sustain over time. Because in the servant leader model, you put your mission first, you put the welfare of your team second, and you put your own welfare a distant third. And that is very hard to do because it's just hard to subordinate your own self-interest all the time. In this case, the Marines and the military in general, but the Marines do a great job of this, they believe that if you want to sustain that, you have to deliberately pursue character. And that once you do that, you can sustain a broader and more overarching mission. Ours was to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the Christian life is no different. Many seem to think, though, that it is. We have a mission, and we have got to build character. And that's a word that is thrown around a lot. And people, it's viewed as a good, but very few, I'd say, in popular culture have a really good sense of what exactly that is, because too many people are afraid to say, that is absolute. These are virtues that everyone must have, regardless of time or space or context. And the sad thing is, a lot of modern leadership literature has completely lost focus of this. They focus on how to do stuff. They don't focus on who to become. However, the Christian life, the military, and certainly the Christian life calls us first to focus on who we are to become in the service of our broader mission, which is to make disciples of all men. My life has been turned upside down no fewer than half a dozen times, and I'm going through something right now which may just turn it upside down again. And to make it through that, one thing that I took out of combat is that you can make it through almost anything if you know what your mission is. And your mission is about more than yourself. It's got to be about more than your own happiness, about more than your own comfort, or the pursuit of those two. Those two things are byproducts. And life has to be about more than that. Typically, and particularly in the Christian context, a worthy mission is going to involve some component of sacrifice. Because at the end of the day, the only way that people know that we value something as they watch the price that we're willing to pay for it. And we only have a finite amount of time on this earth, because we're going to have to be justified before the Lord. We're going to have to stand in front of Him, and He is going to look at us and say, either, well done, good and faithful servant, or you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And I live my life in fear of that. I try to make my mission in the same way that it was in the core, about something more than myself, and that is to bring honor to Jesus, to bring honor to my family, to bring honor to my country, and to still bring honor to the Marines, because just because I don't wear the uniform doesn't mean I can't still serve. I would encourage all of you, Christian and non-Christian alike, to think about what it is that your life stands for. What is it that you want written on your tombstone when you are dead? Do you want something written like, made the number 32 quarters in a row? Or, loving father, devoted husband, light to a darkened world? I seriously encourage you, think about what your mission is and align your time, align your energy, and align your resources accordingly. Having done that, once you understand your mission fully, once you've embraced it, just like in the Corps, the military certainly teaches that the next thing that you have to do is pursue character, pursue specific virtues with the same discipline and intentionality with which we pursue anything else in life. For example, if I'm going to run a marathon, I will train for the marathon. I will construct a running plan, I will go out and run, and then I will hopefully do it. It would be ludicrous for me to decide I am going to run a marathon, and 7 months later, I have done nothing, and I go out and run it and expect to complete it in, you know, under 3 hours. People would laugh at me if I were to do that. But in many cases, that's kind of how we approach character. We think, okay, this is a great thing. I really respect it, and it's something that I'm going to go do. And that's where it ends. The one thing that I really liked about the military is that it did a great job of teaching the disciplined and intentional pursuit of character. Christ teaches that our virtues are not debatable, that they're absolute, and the Christians are to pursue these absolutes in a very specific manner. Study the scriptures, pray, spend time with other believers regularly and intentionally. These are not things that Christ recommends as nice to do. These are things that we must do if we are to develop our character and we are to live a Christian life and glorify God and bring honor to our missions on earth. There are some virtues that I think are worth talking about that, again, I pull from the military context, but have really helped inform how I think about my life as a Christian and how I think about how I can become a better Christian. The first thing that sort of I pulled out of that context is the virtue of humility, which I define as, or sort of, this is a spin on, again, the military definition, seeing yourself through God's eyes, seeing yourself as you really are, not as you wish yourself to be. This is the virtue that that I would say keeps mission from devolving into zealotry. It is the virtue that helps put guardrails around the intense pursuit of something that is worth giving your life for, that helps you really moderate that and keep yourself pursuing it in a wise and just manner. What are some ways to think about doing this? Surround yourself with like-minded believers. Meet with them regularly. Honestly and transparently share life with them. Seek out constructive criticism deliberately. The military constructed recurring forums for constructive criticism called after action. Another virtue is excellence, which is defined not so much by the outcome as by the input, which is giving our best at the day we have in front of us, because we do, in fact, have a day in which to give our best. One of my gunnery sergeants summed it up appropriately. He said, when we were going through Officer Kennedy, he said, "Candidates, let me tell you something. At the end of the day, I want you to chant this chant. Today I have given all that I have. That which I have kept, I have lost forever." And I never forgot that. Another virtue that I think is worth thinking about as we pursue ethics is kindness. It's something that often gets lost in modern society and certainly in American society. That is emotion put into action in a very specific way. It's compassion, action, an action that involves grace, giving someone something that they don't deserve, and some level of sacrifice, giving of yourself to make that grace come to life. I think kindness helps us maintain our joy in life. It helps make the push to fulfill our missions actually something that we like doing, something that is not always a beating. Another key virtue coming from the military was discipline, which many think of as punishment. But in reality, it comes from the Latin word discipula, which means teaching or learning. The best definition probably of this virtue is training that corrects, molds, or perfects mental faculties or moral character. The Corps broke it into two parts, ethical and executional. Ethical meaning doing the right thing, particularly in the small areas where it seems so easy not to. For me, that typically looks like telling white lies or making a promise that I have no intention to fulfill. Executional discipline is hewing to the standards of the organization that you are a part of. Modeling those standards for others, not having one set of standards that applies to you, even if they're not ethical standards, even if they're just behavioral standards, not having one set of standards that apply to you, and then another set of standards that apply to those who are following you. The final virtue that is one of the key ones, maybe the one that underpins all others, is courage. There are two components of courage. Physical courage, which is risking our lives. Moral courage, which is risking our livelihoods. That is the one that most of us have a chance to encounter day in, day out. When we fail to apply it, it can destroy entire societies. There's a quote from a pastor, Martin Niemöller, who, when Hitler came to power in 1935, or in the early 1930s, he initially supported. And then he saw what Hitler was doing. And in 1937, he began to speak out against him and was imprisoned. And here's what he said about the Nazis and about the failure of moral courage, especially in Christians in that country. He said, "In Germany, the Nazis came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I was a Jew. Well, I was not a Jew. And then they came for me. And by the time they came for me, there was no one left to speak up." The failure to have moral courage can destroy entire societies. And I encourage each of you to think about, how is it that you can be brave day in and day out? How is it that you can pursue the virtue of courage day in and day out? And the last thing I want to leave with you is this. I have a lot of friends who do not have any days left because they bled their days out in a nameless street in a nameless city that no one here is ever going to know. My buddy Winchester would love another day with his wife, his widow, who we moved out of her of their house when we got back. He's not going to have it. My buddy Shelby's three kids would love some more time with him, but they're not going to get it because he died in a helicopter crash in Iraq. 15% of my infantry officers course is dead now, and these are guys that I you know I know well. I spent a ton of time with. They're my friends, and they don't have any more days on earth. And when I came back and I looked at the fact that I was still alive, when some of my men and many of my friends are still dead, I began asking, you know, God, why me? And I began to realize that each day is a precious gift. It is very easy to assume that we have tomorrow, that tomorrow is a given, but it is not. Tomorrow is, in fact, a gift. And there are a lot of guys I know that would love another tomorrow, that would love one more day on this earth, that would love the gift of time, but they're not going to get it. But I have it. And so the question that I ask myself, and I try to ask myself day in and day out, is if I have this precious gift, which so many of my friends want and will never have, how do I make the most of it? How do I say, Lord, today you have given me something that so many do not have. How can I give it back? And I don't know how to live each day like it's my last because it's just so hard to understand what it's like to die. But I do know this. Often I don't have as much control in tomorrow as I would like, but I do have the tasks that are in front of me each day. And it is my job to do my best at exactly what I have in front of me with each day that is given to me, because to do anything less is a slap in the face to those living and dead who no longer have any days left. It is my job to take the opportunities that are given to me as responsibilities, to give my all at them, because I, in fact, do have these opportunities. It is my job to understand that with every right I have comes a commensurate duty. It is my job to identify my mission and to pursue it single-mindedly. It is my job to make myself the best man that I can be, to pursue character and to pursue virtue with discipline and with intentionality like anything else that I want to be good at, because I try to live in fear that at the end of days, which may be sooner than I think and may be sooner than I want, I'm going to look at all of my possessions. God is going to look at all the gifts he has been given to me, and he's going to look me in the eyes and he's going to say, with everything that you were given, you serve primarily yourself. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And I don't want that to happen. I want him to look at me and I want him to say, with everything that you have been given, you multiplied it accordingly. You were faithful with the little you were given, and so I gave you more, and you were faithful with that, and you made me more famous on this earth. You did something worth doing. You left a legacy behind that is written into the lives of people and something that will be carried on. I am proud of you. Well done, good and faithful servant. And I know it wasn't easy, and I made things hard for you sometimes, but you endured and you persevered and you became a better man with each passing day. I hope that's what he says to me. My story is still being written, as is yours. And I want to encourage each of you today to think about the people that you are becoming, because I have learned the hard way that when you have to make the most difficult decisions and that when life and death are on the line, it is not the person that you want to be that makes the right decision. It is a person that you have trained yourself to be over time. It is a series of deliberate choices and actions over time that make the hard decisions right in the moment. Thank you all for coming. I really am encouraged to see so many people here who are going to be thinking about ethics, be thinking about doing the right thing. You're going to make an intentional push to do the right thing day in and day out. And my hope and my prayer is this, that the people in this room doing that make a difference in the lives of others, bring honor to God, and make this great country of ours and make these young men better make this great place that we call America a place that these guys who are overseas giving of their time, giving of their energy, and some days, sometimes giving of their lives, a place worth giving their lives for. We as Christians, if we don't do it, I don't know who else will. I don't know who else is going to go out and make this world a little bit better for Jesus. If we want to do that, we have got to make ourselves the people that Jesus calls us to be. Thank you guys so much for being here. I very much appreciate it. I'm excited to see what God does.